Today is Thursday, April 1st, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden proposes $2 trillion infrastructure plan.
I'm proposing a one-time capital investment of roughly $2 trillion in America's future, spread largely over 8 years.
Also, fighting rages in northern Mozambique city of Palma.
A UN spokesman said 5,300 displaced people have been registered in different districts of Cabo Delgado.
Plus, a report on the impact of COVID-19 and gender gap. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S. President Joe Biden has called for a sweeping use of government power to reshape the world's largest economy and counter China's rise in a $2 trillion-plus proposal that has been met with swift political resistance. Biden's proposal plans to put millions of Americans to work, building infrastructure such as roads, as well as tackling climate change and boosting human services like elder care.
It's not a plan that tinkers around the edges. It's a once-in-a-generation investment in America, unlike anything we've seen or done since we built the interstate highway system and the space race decades ago. We have to move now, because I'm convinced that if we act now, in 50 years, people are going to look back and say, this was the moment that America won the future. What I'm proposing is a one-time capital investment of roughly $2 trillion in America's future, spread largely over 8 years. It will generate historic job growth, historic economic growth, help businesses to compete internationally, create more revenue as well. They are among the highest value investments we can make in the nation, investing in our infrastructure.
That's President Biden. Many members of the opposition Republican Party have criticized the infrastructure plan as government overreach and too expensive. A Hong Kong court found 7 prominent Democrats guilty of unauthorized assembly charges, including 82-year-old barrister Martin Lee and media tycoon Jimmy Lai, 72. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
The case is seen as the latest crackdown by China on its freest city after the imposition of a sweeping national security law last year. The 82-year-old barrister Martin Lee and media tycoon Jimmy Lai were among the defendants. Lee helped launch Hong Kong's largest opposition Democratic Party in the 1990s and is often referred to as the city's father of democracy. Another defendant, pro-democracy activist Lee Chuck Yun, spoke to reporters outside the court.
In this day of reckoning, the political suppression is equally to all those who have taken part in the protest movement, including no matter whether you are the peaceful non-violence group or the braver, you are all caught under this political suppression wave.
The court case relates to a peaceful demonstration held on August the 18th in 2019, which grew into an unauthorized march as numbers swelled into the hundreds of thousands. During the trial, defense lawyers argued that freedom of assembly is a constitutional right in Hong Kong. But the district court judge said that that right was not absolute and argued that restrictions are imposed to preserve public safety and order. Sentencing will come later, with some legal experts expecting jail terms of 12 to 18 months. The maximum possible sentence is 5 years.
That's Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. The Pan American Health Organization said on Wednesday that countries in the Americas could see a worse surge in coronavirus cases than the previous surge last year, with Brazil, Uruguay, and Cuba already suffering more. This, as Pfizer and BioNTech said their COVID-19 vaccine is safe, effective, and produces robust antibody responses in 12 to 15-year-olds. Freddie Joyner of Reuters has more.
Pfizer and BioNTech on Wednesday said their COVID-19 vaccine was safe and effective and produced robust antibody responses in 12 to 15-year-olds, setting the stage for them to seek approval in the United States and Europe within weeks, and offering hope for a return to in-person schooling nationwide. Their vaccine was authorized by U.S. regulators in late December for people aged 16 and older. The new study offers the first evidence of how the vaccine will work in school-age adolescents, putting the two companies ahead of other Western vaccine developers in the quest to protect children from the virus. A trial by Moderna to test its COVID-19 vaccine in children aged 6 months to less than 12 years was launched this month, while Johnson & Johnson has yet to begin a planned trial. AstraZeneca in December removed children from a mid-to-late stage trial of its COVID-19 vaccine in Britain. The Pfizer-BioNTech trial was of 2,260 adolescents aged 12 to 15. There were 18 cases of COVID-19 in the group that got a placebo shot and none in the group that got the vaccine, resulting in 100% efficacy in preventing COVID-19, the company said in a statement. The vaccine was well tolerated, with side effects in line with those seen in the earlier adult trial. Last week, the companies gave the first vaccine doses in a series of trials testing the vaccine in younger children that will eventually go to those as young as 6 months of age. Pfizer's chief executive, Albert Bourla, said the company planned to seek emergency authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, quote, in the coming weeks, and to other regulators around the world. He added that he hopes to start vaccinating the younger age group before the start of the next school year.
That's Freddie Joyner of Reuters. The coronavirus pandemic has made a deep mark in Africa's megacities such as Johannesburg, Lagos, and Nairobi. But more than half of the continent's population lives in rural areas, which strict lockdowns have effectively sealed off. VOA's Anita Powell visited one small South African town to see how its residents are coping under pandemic restrictions.
It's hard to see COVID-19 here in the town of Kamatsamo. Goats pick their way through a path that runs from the highway, the main thoroughfare in this South African town of some 23,000 people. On a recent day, most residents weren't diligently wearing masks outdoors, as is the law. But the pandemic is deeply felt here, say residents, who point not to death tolls, but to economic and social devastation. South Africa is the continent's epicenter, with more than 1.5 million confirmed cases and more than 52,000 deaths. Bakare Sambo is a bright 22-year-old with a dream. She wants to learn a trade and eventually set up her own carpentry shop. That idea flew out the window when the pandemic arrived, and she had to make different plans.
It's been a problem, like really problem, a big problem to me, because I can't continue with my carpentry studies. I just stopped, and I can't even start my own business because the money is too low. People are complaining they can't even buy this fruit. They're complaining, they say it's too much money.
Data about COVID's impact on Africa's urban-rural divide is still being gathered. But one recent study from a group of Nigerian and British researchers warns that rural African communities risk being left behind in the pandemic because of the lack of amenities like good road networks and clinics and hospitals. Anita Powell, VOA News, Kamatsamo, South Africa.
The World Economic Forum says women will have to wait 135.6 years to achieve global gender parity. The forum's Global Gender Gap Report 2021 finds that impact of COVID-19 has set back efforts to close the gender gap by a generation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
For the 12th consecutive year, Iceland tops the rankings as the most gender-equal country in the world, followed by Finland, Norway, New Zealand, and Sweden. Two African countries, Namibia and Rwanda, enter the rankings of 156 countries in 6th and 7th place, with Switzerland rounding up the top 10. Afghanistan is at the bottom of the ranking survey. The United States has moved up 23 positions to number 30. Authors of the report say that jump in gender parity is due to improvements in the new makeup of the U.S. administration. China is in the top half of the G20 and is ahead of all emerging markets, with the exception of Russia. In another advance for gender equality, the United Arab Emirates has broken into the top half of the rankings, the first Arab country to do so. The report finds women face many hurdles in the workplace, hurdles made worse by the pandemic. World Economic Forum Managing Director Sadia Zahidi says many more women than men have lost jobs because of COVID-19 lockdowns. She says women also assume greater responsibilities in housework, child, and elder care in the household.
The sectors that have been the most impacted by the lockdowns across the world tend to be sectors that are also large employers of women. So the consumer and retail sector that has been impacted globally, the travel and tourism industry that has been impacted globally, These are all sectors that tend to be large employers of women.
Another problem that will further handicap women's ability to move ahead in the post-COVID-19 period is the changing face of work. Sue Duke is head of global public policy at LinkedIn. She says women are not well represented in fast-growing jobs of tomorrow, such as cloud computing, engineering, and AI data products.
We have seen a rapid acceleration in digitization and technology being integrated into all aspects of our lives. We have to have women's voices, perspectives represented at that foundational formative stage and playing an equal role in what technology is developed, how it's deployed, and precisely what impact it's going to have.
The report says Western Europe continues to be the best performing region, with nearly 78% of its overall gender gap closed. North America, comprising Canada and the United States, comes in a close second. The report finds sub-Saharan Africa has made slow progress and that it will take 121.7 years to close the gender gap, given the present rate of improvement. South Asia is the second lowest performer. However, the report says the Middle East and North Africa continue to be regions with the largest gender gap to be closed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In the U.S., President Biden is getting high marks for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic in a new poll from the Associated Press. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Americans have responded favorably to President Biden's approach to handling the pandemic, with 73% approval in a new Associated Press NORC poll. That includes about half the Republicans surveyed, a rarity since many issues have been divided by political affiliation. Overall, Biden's job approval sits at a healthy 61% as he enters his third month in office. But Americans are more critical of Biden's early approach to some hot-button issues. On gun policy, only 45% back Biden's approach for new measures, while 52% disapprove. And only 42% like how Biden is handling immigration. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
The trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer charged in the death of George Floyd, continues for a third day in the U.S. state of Minnesota as more witnesses to Floyd's final moments take the stand. VOA's Jesus Man Oni has this report.
Surveillance video capturing George Floyd's final moments is played in a Minnesota courtroom as prosecutors lay out the sequence of events that led to his death.
Oh my God.
Day three of the murder trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin brought emotional testimony from several eyewitnesses. Charles McMillan said he felt helpless trying to get Floyd to calm down as officers struggled to get him into the back of a squad car.
And I'm trying to get him to understand that when you make a mistake, once they get you a cup, it's no certain thing as being class, but you're going to go with them.
Minutes before the police encounter, Floyd is seen inside a convenience store where he bought cigarettes with a suspected fake $20 bill. Christopher Martin, the store clerk and one of the last people to speak with Floyd, testified he seemed friendly but under the influence of drugs.
I had asked him if he played baseball. He went on to respond to that, but it kind of took him a little long to get to what he was trying to say, so it would appear that he was high.
An autopsy confirmed fentanyl and methamphetamine in Floyd's blood, and Chauvin's defense lawyers argue Floyd's drug use had an impact on his health.
You also indicated that he was having some trouble with certain words.
Correct. He was trying to form the words.
After receiving that alleged counterfeit bill from Floyd, Martin testified he eventually told his manager. After confronting Floyd, the police were called. But as the situation unfolded, Martin recalls his disbelief and feelings of guilt.
Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
Over the last 3 days, several eyewitnesses, including teenagers, have described to jurors the shock of watching Floyd struggle while pinned underneath Chauvin's knee. The case sparked global protest against police brutality against black people. The trial is expected to last several weeks. Jason Samelny, VOA News.
This is the Voice of America. Protesters in Myanmar are marking 2 months since the military seized power by once more defying the threat of lethal violence and publicly demonstrating against the toppling of the democratically elected government. Protests were held Thursday in several cities, including Yangon. Also on Thursday, Britain announced sanctions against the Myanmar Economic Corporation for its role in serious human rights violations, a week after Washington cracked down on the military-linked conglomerate. MEC and another military-linked conglomerate called Myanmar Economic Holdings dominate many sectors of the resource-rich Southeast Asian country's economy, including trading, alcohol, cigarettes, and consumer goods. After seizing power in February from a civilian government, Myanmar's military has regained control of state companies. Through the two highly secretive conglomerates, at least 133 companies in the country are wholly or partially overseen by generals, the group Justice for Myanmar alleges. MEL has partnership with companies in China, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, among others. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Mexico is about to legalize marijuana for recreational use, turning a Latin American nation into the world's largest market for the drug. The move comes after Mexico's lower house of Congress passed a legislation bill early in March, and the country's Senate is expected to approve a similar measure in coming weeks. Michael Sullivan looks at what legalization of the cannabis plant means for Mexico and the United States, the country's northern neighbor.
Mexico now about to become the third country in the Western Hemisphere, after Uruguay and Canada, to make marijuana legal for recreational use by adults. It was a change ordered by the country's Supreme Court and backed by President Andrés Manuel López Obrador and former President Vicente Fox. Recreational marijuana use will become law when Mexico's Senate approves the legalization bill, as expected, before the end of April. Steve D'Angelo is a cannabis investor and activist.
Mexico is on the verge of becoming the largest legal cannabis market in the world. It's much bigger than Canada by virtue of its larger population. It's much bigger than Uruguay.
In the U.S., 36 states allow marijuana for medical use, and 16 states and the District of Columbia have approved recreational marijuana, including most recently New York, but the drug remains illegal at the federal level. In Mexico, cartels dominate the illegal trade in marijuana, and the country's war on drugs has led to more than 150,000 deaths and 80,000 persons missing. Legalization of marijuana will help end the violence, say supporters of the measure, as the cartels shift to other activities. Edgardo Buscaglia is a researcher in law and economics at Columbia University.
Trafficking of migrants, counterfeiting of money, currency.
And other drugs, he says. The cartels might still traffic marijuana if they can offer a lower price than legal producers. Advocates say marijuana has medical uses, but it's not without risk. Andrew Peterson of University of the Sciences.
About potentially 9% or so of the users, regular users of it, may develop a cannabis use disorder. And that is not insignificant.
And even though Mexico's legalization may potentially be a good thing, say some analysts, the country's legal framework needs reform to prevent abuse. Edgardo Buscaglia.
There's a lack of control, a complete lack of control in the consumption of alcohol and cigarettes among minors, 12, 11, 10-year-olds in Mexico City, in Guadalajara, in Chihuahua. So that is happening with legal drugs.
Despite the challenges, Mexico is about to join a growing global market. Marijuana legalization can bring the government needed cash and help poor farmers, says another analyst, Bo Whitney of Whitney Economics.
And close the gap between income in the South versus already prosperous income in the North.
The United States, where marijuana remains illegal on a federal level, will soon be wedged between two large legal marijuana markets. These experts ask, how will Washington respond? Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
New Yorkers can now possess up to 3 ounces of cannabis under a legislation bill signed by Governor Andrew Cuomo. AP correspondent Judy Walker reports.
Under the bill, possession of small amounts of marijuana is legal. There'll also be programs to help communities that bore the brunt of national and state drug wars. And eventually, it'll allow the sales of marijuana in the state to people over the age of 21. Mayor Bill de Blasio is praising it.
This is a hugely important moment for the state of New York.
Lawmakers estimate the legalization of recreational marijuana and other pot products will eventually bring in $300 million a year to cover the state's cost of regulating and enforcing the program. Julie Walker, New York.
Authorities in Tanzania took more than a week to confirm that 45 people died in a stampede at the memorial for late President John Magufuli. Relatives of those killed are angry about the delay and also want organizers of the event to be held responsible. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
Speaking with local newspapers, City Police Commander Lazaro Mambosasa said 37 people were also injured in the incident, but all have been discharged from local hospitals. One family lost 5 relatives in the stampede, and a house attendant was also declared missing for 2 days before family members found her dead at one hospital in the city. This created tensions with the girl's family, said family spokesperson Gerard Mtua. We expected they would release the information very soon because they are safety apparatus and have a very good mechanism to find and release it, says Mtua. Now, delaying of the information has created misunderstanding because at this tragedy, there was a house girl, he says. So delaying the information, even the family of the house girl from another place, even her family will not understand us. Human rights activists are demanding those behind the tragedy and the delay of information to be held accountable. Rugemeleza Nshala is the president of Tanganyika Law Society. He says people should be held accountable for why they have taken so long without telling people about the incident. There were only rumors circulating on social media on the issue. He says Article 14 of our Constitution guarantees the right for people to live and given security. So if the police fail, it is not right. Every person is equal under the law, and the life of everyone matters. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Mozambican soldiers have been battling insurgents in the northern gas town of Palma, as aid groups warn that tens of thousands have fled an attack that has been claimed by Islamic State. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
This is the scene on the ground in the Mozambican gas town of Palma, site of a deadly militant attack that's been claimed by Islamic State. Footage obtained by local TV station TVM on Tuesday showed soldiers deployed to regain control after insurgents invaded a week ago. Mozambique's government has confirmed dozens of deaths, and the operation remains active. In the middle of an interview with soldiers, gunshots and a dash for cover. Army spokesman Colonel Chongo Vidigal said there were no longer any big groups of terrorists in the town.
The forces are gaining territory, yes. We are occupying practically, we are extending our control all across.
The attack has triggered an exodus of thousands. A UN spokesman said 5,300 displaced people have been registered in different districts of Cabo Delgado. The northern province has been home to a simmering Islamist insurgency since 2017. In the coming days, the number of displaced is expected to rise. Since Tuesday, more than 300 survivors have made it to the provincial capital Pemba by plane and boat, a senior humanitarian official said. A boat carrying another 1,000 was expected to arrive late on Wednesday. A small group is also reported to have fled north to Tanzania, though others failed to make that journey because of a difficult river crossing. Aid groups say tens of thousands are probably displaced, with people scattering into dense forest or attempting to escape by sea.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson. I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Thank you so much.